Right, so today I'm speaking about bright versus dark in natural scenes, namely how information lives in bright versus dark components of natural scenes, and how we believe that this has direct implications for the anatomical and functional structure of retina in the organization of the on versus off channels. So much of the work on this project has been done by Dutch Ratliff, who's right there. I was also at Penn. And we've also benefited from collaborating with Peter Sterling, David Brainard, and Harry Cao. I'll briefly mention some other results which were obtained in collaboration with a variety of others. So let me mention them too. And they are Michael Berry, who's at Princeton, Michael Fried, who's at Penn, Don Kimber, who's at Xerox, Kristen Koch, and Judith McLean, who are at Penn. Okay, so just to remind you about the structure of the eye and the brain, here's a photograph, a drawing of the brain taken from David Hubel's book. You're looking at it from the underneath. And here's the eye, the two eyes. The optic nerve goes back to the visual cortex back there. And we would like to understand, the purpose of this workshop is to try to understand something about how that thing is designed and organized. Now, hey. This is my first keynote or PowerPoint talk ever, so bear with me. There will be learning, there's a learning curve. So the red line over there is the retina. And the retina, as you know, is the layer of neurons that sits at the base of the eye and provides all of the primary sensory input that from the visual world that goes to your brain. Now I'm putting this picture up partly because we should remember that the retina is really should be understood as a part of central brain. It projects directly to central brain, and much of our thinking about how the central brain is designed and organized is actually derived from models that were previously thought about in retina. So how is the retina actually organized? Well, here's a slice through the retina. It's a complicated object. But in brief, it has sort of three layers. There's a photoreceptor layer at the top over there. Coming back down, there's the bipolar cell layer, which processes information from the photoreceptor layer in some sort of analog manner. And at the bottom, there's the ganglion cell layer. And the ganglion cells have long axons, which project to the brain. And the output of the ganglion cells is what you see. There are also, of course, lots of horizontal connections that are horizontal cells, amacrine cells. Their structure, their function is not fully understood yet. And as Peter was discussing in his talk a little while back, that is a major subject of continuing thinking. So here's a schematic of the connectivity. What happens is that, as I said, the photoreceptors connect to bipolars, connect to ganglion cells with lots of horizontal and amacrine connections. Now, one basic dichotomy between types of ganglion cells is between on and off ganglion cells. If a given type of ganglion cell, you could have the on variant and the off variant, and the on and off variants basically process bright versus dark versions of the same feature. For example, a bright edge versus a dark edge. And all of these different kinds of cells can be mapped out, and they look different. For example, here, they arborize in different layers of the inner plexiform layer. Just to remind you, again, this is continuing on. This is material that that Peter presented. If you look at the types of different cells that you have, this is an enormously diverse and complicated system. If you just look at bipolar types, there are at least 10 types in monkey and in rat and in mouse. And there's some vague correspondence between them. I mean, it's not perfect, but there's a large number of types in each of these species and doing somewhat similar things. You can find parallels between the types in different creatures. Likewise, here's a picture of, if you think about the ganglion cells, which project to the brain, there's also enormous numbers of different kinds of ganglion cells. So here are a number of ganglion cells from cat retina. And there's the alpha cell and the beta cell, for example. And all of these also have some kinds of parallels in other kinds of organisms, although each organism may have also specific types of cells doing specific things. The reason I'm putting up this sort of list of complications of this, the enormous complexity of the of even just the retina is because, as a physicist personally, one of the first questions that comes to mind when looking at the system is, why does it have to be so complicated? Why does it have to have so many different kinds of cells connected in so many different kinds of ways when, you know, an arbitrary computer could have been built using, you know, NAND gates? And that's obviously not the way we're organized. So, and you might hypothesize that the reason why the organization occurs in this manner is because, well, you need to have a certain amount of behaviorally useful information, let's say, extracted from the natural world. It has to arrive within a certain period of time. There's a certain amount of space to compute it in. There are constraints of energy. There's noise. There's evolution. And maybe if you understand all of these factors at the same time, you could understand why it was that there were a certain number of cells, there were so many cell types, and at least come to an understanding of why you should design, why evolution should design, you know, the alpha and beta cell and not some other kind of cell that did something else. Why are these kinds of cells the ones that are important for evolution to build? So we'd like to get a leg up on this. So we're going to think about, just to get a foothold on this rather complicated problem, we're going to start small with a particular aspect of the diversity of cell types in the retina. And the particular thing that I want to think about is the dichotomy between on and off cells. So here we have a picture of an on beta cell in cat and an off beta cell in cat. They look somewhat different. They arborize in different layers of the retina, etc. And the important thing about them functionally is one important thing, the difference between them functionally, is that off cells respond to dark patches, and I'll be a little bit more precise as to what I mean by that later, and on cells respond to bright patches. And across species, and across cell type, and across eccentricity in the retina, there are certain systematic differences that are conserved. For example, first of all, off cells tend to be 20 to 50% smaller. Right? This varies slightly from type to type and varies a little bit with eccentricity, but they're smaller. A priori, if you had believed in something like efficient coding, you might have thought this is sort of maybe contradictory, because you might have thought that a cell that processes dark patches gets less photons, thus has more noise, and therefore needs to be bigger to collect more photons. So you might have thought that the prediction of efficient coding might go in the opposite way to what you actually see. But we would see that that's not the case.
Smaller, you mean the dendritic
processes? The center, the dendritic process is smaller. Right? If you look at the receptive field, by smaller I mean if you look at the receptive field of the cell, the receptive field is literally smaller. Next, they're more numerous. In guinea pig, for example, for every on cell of a given type, you'll find 2.75 or so of the off type. Third, they have greater receptive field overlap. So off cells sort of tile, sort of, if you look at this picture, we try to represent that with the off cells kind of having more overlapping dendritic processes. So you might think their information would say perhaps more redundant. Now, why should that be? Also, because of the finer spacing of off cells, they sample the scenes at higher resolution. And you can also just measure the fact that the dendritic arbor of off cells is much denser than the dendritic arbor of on cells, although they are smaller. So the net wire length that the two kinds of cells have is actually roughly the same. And the number of synapses they make with bipolar cells is probably roughly the same, although the actual area they cover is different. Okay. So finally, one other difference that's conserved is that off cells are more rectified. Off cells only respond to dark patches, whereas on cells respond to bright patches, but also, you know, to some dark patches. So, and this is just systematic across species, across cell type, etc. So this gives us, since it's so systematic across so many variations, you might ask, can you build a theory of why this should be the case? So our hypothesis is going to be that the structural and functional asymmetries of off versus on channels basically arise from asymmetries between dark and bright regions of natural stimuli. There are contrary hypotheses that you could have made. You could have made the hypothesis that in order to process, you know, that there was a computational difference between the processing of bright and dark. Here we're proposing that it's just entirely tied to the structure of the natural world. And primarily in this talk, in the large part of this talk, I'm basically going to present This is going to be, for me, an unusual thing, an experimental talk. I'm going to present experimental evidence that natural scenes do have asymmetries in their information content, so in such a manner that the dark regions are more numerous and more informative. And then, at the end, I'll briefly suggest how optimization of the information transfer through retina will precisely predict then, from that data, the asymmetries that you actually see in the structure and function of on versus off channels. Okay, so I'm going to start out by thinking about what do I mean by bright versus dark patches, and we're going to pick the simplest possible model that we can think of. So as I said, on and off cells respond to a stimulus of local contrast, basically. I mean, all cells basically respond to local contrast. So the on cell responds to, say, bright central spot and a darker surround, and vice versa for the off cell. And here's a picture from Zaglu, Bohan, and them showing how showing spike responses to flashes of this kind. Now, the simplest model that we can make for what this receptive field is. So what I've drawn here is a picture of more or less the receptive field. Of course, each cell has variant receptive fields, and each cell type has a somewhat different receptive field, and we have to think about the spatiotemporal properties, etc. But we should start simple. And the simplest model is just simply a difference of Gaussians. This is a standard model that people use to represent contrast in visual scenes. So here's a difference of Gaussians. And specifically, is that font too small? Can people read it back there? OK. So we'll define percent contrast, basically, to be the following thing. We'll convolve a Gaussian against the intensity image, subtract the convolution of a wider Gaussian with intensity image, and then normalize out by the result of the surround. That basically is a measure of contrast that gives you the percent extra brightness in the middle as compared to the surround. So this sort of divisive, you might argue, right, in the end, so at the moment, for the bulk of this talk, I'm basically going to discuss properties of natural scenes under filtering by filters of this kind. So as such, well, that's it. I mean, that's precisely what I've done. There's nothing that can be argued with. However, one might argue about, are these kinds of filters the ones that are implemented by the retina? In particular, is this kind of divisive normalization the kind of thing the retina does or doesn't do, etc.? Basically, because there's both short and long timescale adaptations all over the place in the retina, which one has to keep one's eye a little bit on. So I refer you to a review by Tadmore and Tolhurst, where they study different kinds of models of contrast. And this is one that works reasonably well, and certainly accords intuitively to the notion of what contrast is. So this is what we're going to stick with, at least for the present time. And we can later on discuss in the talk other kinds of model of contrast.
That's the same as a smooth adaptive derivative and average over all
directions. What's that?
It's the same as a smooth derivative, which I'm averaging over all directions.
In effect. Right. You just blur the image with the center and then blur it with the surround. I mean, it basically mimics, it's the most primitive model you could have made of receptive field, right? Part of the reason that we want to keep it primitive is we want to argue that our results are going to be basically universal and are not going to care particularly about the precise wiggles in the receptive field of a particular cell. Right? Our results are just going to hold for any kind of specific function. So if I look at that, we're also always going to pick an equal weight center and surround so that constant intensity gives zero response. This mimics the behavior of most cells where you give it a constant intensity. After a bit, the thing stops saying anything. And I'm going to define the center radius of this filter to be the radius where the weighting becomes negative, so that it's really the excitatory center versus the inhibitory surround. This is different from the language used. The reason I'm mentioning this is very often when people say center radius, they mean the variance or the standard deviation of the center Gaussian. That's not what I'm going to mean. I'm going to use the more anatomical terminology here. And I'm also going to fix the surround radius always at 5 times the center radius. That's because that's roughly the way things work in real cells, and that's one variable I don't want to have to deal with. We have checked that if you change this number around, our results don't change in any significant manner. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to see, let's suppose that the retina processes visual scenes by sort of basically implementing a mosaic of such filters and extracting bright versus dark components, bright versus dark contrast components from it. So we need a database of images to look at to see what are the bright versus dark components. So we use a standard database. This is Van Hatteren's famous natural stimulus collection. And the photographs are taken, God help us, near Groningen, Netherlands. So you know, you get Dutch-type flowers, lots of cows, bicycles, you know, that kind of stuff. You may very well, and you should rightly question, what is the relevance of so particular a set of images taken in rural and urban Netherlands to the visual system of the guinea pig, which evolved in the upper Andes. But we are going to try to claim that the results are going to be more or less universal, that it's not going to matter very much. We're going to test this. First of all, this is a standard database, so it's important to do things here. We're going to split our images into rural versus urban and see how the results change. And to really settle the matter, we are collecting a lovely new database from Botswana, where, and we will really nail the question of environmental dependence there. So we will take care of that issue. But in the meantime, let me just tell you some technicalities. It's monochromatic images. We're not interested in color. We will be maybe on another round. Van Hatteren did a lot of work to make sure that the numbers he reports to the intensities are linear in intensities, because otherwise that could screw up your results. And it's a 12-bit, about a million pixel image. And the 12034 is wrong. I think it's 1203. That's right, right. I mean, what you're raising is how much does one's results depend on these on the particular set of images? That's a very good question to raise. If you look at some of the rural images here, you know, they look like rural images should, right? Like this thing looks like you might be looking at a bush, or there are cows sitting in a field, you know, stuff like that. So those look less artificial. Surprisingly to me, anyway, the results from rural and urban are actually quite close. There's a slight difference, which is interesting, which I will. What? What's that? Well, they'd be stolen. Okay, so let's start out. The basic first piece of data that we need is what is the distribution of intensities in scenes like this, right? This has been done many times before, and for us it serves as a reality check that we know what we're doing. And if you look at the probability density that a random pixel takes a particular intensity as a function of log pixel intensity, it sort of peaks up, and look at the extremely long tail. So it's very skew and sort of peaks up somewhere over there. If you do this without taking a log here, the peak occurs almost near zero, and then the tail goes on forever and forever. One important point to keep in mind is that individual scenes can actually be rather different in their distribution of intensities from the ensemble. So what we are going to do is, of course, we are going to we're going to compute for all of our results an ensemble average. We'll do filterings and measure statistics in individual scenes, then average over scenes. It's an interesting question how much variation there is from scene to scene, and we'll return to that later. That may be important as a point, but we'll come back.
Is it clear that are the absolute intensities?
What do you mean?
Mm.
So he claims to calibrate it. So you know, you can have a light meter that basically counts photons and try to guarantee that if you report the number 10, it meant something in terms of number of photons arriving. Van Hatteren claims across scenes, right? I mean, because you can go with a light meter in every place and verify that your camera does the right thing. Now, the number it reports, right? Cameras often have fancy processing in them. And you've got to guarantee that it hasn't done fancy processing on your image. And Van Hatteren claims that that's the case. Of course, we don't know. So our new fancy database will do all of that just right. Okay, but I'm reasonably confident, because this jives with results many people have had before, including possibly you. Okay, so I'm just going to show you a picture of, you know, what it looks like. So what we're going to do is we're going to convolve these filters against the scene, and then we're going to threshold, so that if it turns up with a positive contrast, that's an on response, and if it's a negative contrast, it's an off response. And we're going to segregate the scene in this way into the bright versus dark components. And I want to show you what the pictures look like as we take this image and you convolve it against these filters at different scale sizes. Right? We're going to be interested in looking at image at small scales and bigger scales, ever bigger scales, and that's going to be the give us interesting regularities that we want to go after. So now here, what we're doing is we're going to put some filter on top, and then here, what's been done is the scene has been filtered with these center surround filters in which the center size was only 1 pixel wide. And then it's only those filters that have been given you negative responses. Negative contrasts have been kept. And this is the piece of the scene, but this is the scene that survives. And then you keep going. And as you blur it more and more, of course, it gets blurred more and more. So at 20 pixels, this is the way it is. Now, it's worth, just to give a sense of scale, right? These images are about 1,000 by 1,000 pixels. So the center is 20 pixels wide, and the surround is 5 times that. That's 100 pixels. So basically now, we're looking at filters that are looking at 10% of the image at a time, if you include the surround. Just to give you a sense of how wide a scale, set of scales we're looking at. So we're going from 1,000th of the image, roughly, to 1/200th of the image, to 1/10th of the image in the size of the image that's probed by the surround. Now, I'll do this in the inverse way with the on channel. So for some reason, this came out very dark. We should have normalized this a bit more. But anyway, so now you see how the picture blurs out more and more. And of course, this is what your brain roughly sees, right? This is the receptive field that your brain has. So it's worth keeping that in mind. So we've got the center radius 20 pixels. Now I'll move on. So what are the distributions of local contrasts that you get from these filters? Well, let's see. So what we're doing here is we have 100 natural images. We've convolved all these images with these filters with center sizes 1, 5, and 20. So again, very small filters that cover 1/200th of the image, and large filters that cover 10% of the image. And we just build up how many positive, what is the distribution of contrasts. And this is what you see. So let's see. So at any scale size, if you look at these curves, you will see that there is a skew towards negative contrasts. There's more probability mass on the left side of these curves than on the right side of these curves. Also, as you increase the size of the filters, the image basically moves out, right? You get more bright and dark contrasts. This should already be giving you pause. The reason it should be giving you pause is you would have thought that if I'd given you an image, right, and I gave you big, humongous filters, yay big, to filter the image with, that it would gray out the image. Graying out an image means that the contrast that you measure would get more and more near zero, right? You get more near vanishing contrast because everything getting blurred out. But that's obviously not what's happening. The contrasts near zero are decreasing with center size and going up. This is very different from what you would have sort of naively said would happen. And we would like to think about that a little bit more.
That's because of the structure of your normalization, right? The statement you made would have to be true if it were a linear operation because you were passing less power.
Well, what I will show you is that if you gave you a random image, right, Gaussian, just give me a second, you'll see that this is not the same behavior as you get for random images.
I didn't say that it arises as a part of normalization. I'm saying that the discrepancy between the sort of naive argument you gave about blurring and what you actually find is a result.
The discrepancy, I would claim, is a result of correlations in the scene. The normalization matters too, of course. If the filtering you were doing were just linear, this wouldn't happen. But what we're measuring is percent contrast. And even with percent contrast, it's a fact that, as you will see, for random images, you will get a graying out.
Sure. But
the filter matters too. That's what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely. The filter matters too, but without a certain class of correlations in the scene.
Yeah.
Right. But that's what the eye does. That the eye does not report absolute contrast numbers. It's how bright something is relative to something else. That's what the eye actually does. So to that extent, you can view this sort of analysis of natural scene statistics as being sort of inspired. So it's an experimental study of natural scenes inspired by what the eye actually does. Let's think about it like that. Okay. Okay. So there are two comments that I'd like to make. So first of all, given that you get the sort of kurtotic distribution that the natural scenes people often talk about, it's immediately clear that if you wanted to encode the distribution of contrast in an efficient way, let's say in an energy efficient way, it would pay you basically to separate into bright versus dark channels. That's because this thing peaks up near zero, and when the thing is near zero, you'd hope not to send too many spikes. For the common things, you shouldn't send too many spikes. And that would happen if, and if you had a single channel that was sending both bright and dark, your encoding scheme would have to send more spikes. So that's a, so perhaps there's some sort of trade-off here, because if you do that splitting into on versus off channels, you then need more cells and more packing space. Okay, so I'm not claiming this is an argument yet at this point. What I'm going to do is at each point in this talk, I'm going to give suggestions for elements that will eventually enter the argument that we're going to make, right? Okay, so this is just an inspirational statement, so to speak. Okay, also, the mere fact that there is a skew like this suggests that you should devote more resources to processing dark patches. Basically, there's more stuff there. And we'd like to quantify that. What do we mean by saying that there's more stuff in the dark patches? Doesn't make sense to devote more cells, as we actually see in retina, to processing dark patches. So it's interesting to quantify this in this way. So what you can do is, as a function of center size, we're graphing here the percentage of contrasts that are negative, that's the red line, positive, that's the blue line, and null. That's the green line. So the idea, why do we have a null contrast at all? We have a null contrast because typically ganglion cells do not respond if the contrast is below some threshold. Pick your threshold. If you want 1%, 5%, we can put it in and you'll get a similar picture. It doesn't matter very much, but we're picking a threshold from that. And there are several significant points to be mentioned here. First, at all scales, it is a fact that there are more negative contrasts than positive contrasts, this regardless of how you observe the scene. Secondly, as the scale size increases, the number of null contrasts decreases. We already mentioned that this should happen from the previous transparency. And all of this suggests that there should be more off cells than on cells, because there's sort of more things to do in the dark side of things. Okay, but now I'd like to know what aspect of what we have seen is really a property of natural scenes and not just a property of the filter, as you were saying, right? So we can study that in the following simple way. We can make up artificial images that encapsulate some of the properties of natural scenes and try to see which properties were actually important. Oops. So let me remind you about the famous facts that people always repeat about the structure of natural scenes. First of all, there's the intensity distribution, which we already drew, which is very skew, centered at a small, has a peak at small intensity and a very long tail. And then there's the famous fact of the power law correlation to natural scenes. How does this work? Well, you compute the autocorrelation function of intensities, the two-point function, and you graph that as a function of separation. And what you find is a curve like this. Many people have done interesting work on this. Famously, Dan Ruderman and Bill had a very pretty paper on the subject. I'm taking this figure from a review article by Simoncelli and Olshausen. So another way of presenting the same data is you Fourier transform the two-point function, and then you average over orientations. Since you're doing a two-dimensional Fourier transform, this kx and ky, average over the phases, and you'll find that the resulting quantity, the resulting two-point function, falls off as 1 over the frequency squared. So this is a famous fact, and you might ask, can the distribution of intensities in natural scenes, coupled with the known power law correlations, which, by the way, do not encapsulate all the statistics of natural scenes, but certainly encapsulate something important, does that suffice to explain the phenomenon? So let's start out by looking at Gaussian noise, by which I mean pick intensities at individual pixels randomly from a Gaussian distribution, no correlations whatsoever. What you see is this, totally different from what you saw in the previous scene. Of course, in this case, since you've picked intensity sort of from a Gaussian distribution, the number of positive and negative contrasts is identical because there's no skew in the distribution at all around its mean. And of course, as you, given the structure of the filter, as you increase the center size, the image is grayed out. That's what you would have expected in the first place. Graying out here means that if you have a null response, namely contrast less than, I don't know, 3%, you'll find that begins to dominate, and pretty soon, at pretty modest center sizes, all the contrasts are tiny with this definition of contrast. Okay? And if you pick a different definition of contrast, all these curves look different. But you'll find a systematic difference between them anyway. Right. So the invariant statement is that the curves look different as opposed to the specific shape of the curve. The next thing you can do is you can say, well, I'll take Gaussian noise and add in the correlations, power law correlations. This is called pink Gaussian noise. I'm not quite sure why it's pink Gaussian noise, but that's what it's called. And this is what you get. Note again that the number of on and off responses is identical. That has it had to be because the distribution is symmetric. And now, however, the thing is essentially scale invariant. Right? At all scales, you get the same number of bright and dark responses. What's interesting is now this doesn't go to zero. That's because, of course, if randomly you pick up a pixel that's extra bright, the brightness stays, is correlated for some distance. So because of that, you'll get a region that's a little brighter. And that, because of that, you wind up with a situation that things stabilize at some value over there. We believe that this little bit of thing over there is probably an artifact of the, you know, we're dealing with pixels, so, you know, 1 to 2 pixels is a little bit of, there's no scale invariance at that scale, presumably. So that's presumably why that's happening. Okay, so these two, so just putting in the correlation. So the correlations by themselves do not suffice to explain our data. So next, you can now construct artificial images that I'll call natural noise, by which I mean independent, randomly drawn pixels, pixel intensities, drawn from the natural distribution of intensities with its long tail and skew. And here's what you see. Not surprisingly, you see a split between the number of positive and negative contrasts you see at small scales. But again, as you go to larger scales, what's happening here is you're reverting to this picture. It's got to happen, if you have independent pixels, that by the central limit theorem, when you get to sufficiently large regions, you're talking about a Gaussian distributed thing with, you know, certain kinds of intensities, and, well, the number of contrasts that you have that are small just simply grows, again, given the particular shape of the filter that we have right now. So this is obviously not what we see in natural scenes. So the distribution of intensities by itself does not suffice. Finally, let's do natural pink noise. So this is the natural distribution of intensities plus the power law correlations. This is what you get. I'll compare this with the natural scenes in a minute. It's not quite the same. What's that? So what you do is, how do you construct such images? Yeah, that's not easy. So what you do is you first construct the pink noise, and then what you do is you remap the pink noise intensities to the to your desired distribution of intensities. That won't give you, that will mess up the power law a little bit, so you've got to iterate a couple of times. We thank Ben Backus, resident genius, for helping us to make the pink noise images. Okay. What's that? I should have had a couple of those. They look like clouds. What's that?
There's some long scale structure in them.
Well, do clouds have long scale structure? What's that?
Dark clouds which are really fractal like, very long
scale. Well, okay, so I don't have a picture of the thing for you. So all I can say is it looks to me like clouds. Clouds may look different to you, of course, but they look a certain way to me. What I can tell you is if you compute the Fourier transform here and compute the autocorrelation function, you'll get a power law. And, well, if you map the distribution of intensities, you get what you want. So that's all I have to say. So what you get is, happily, you get now a maintained separation between the positive and negative contrast. So that's nice. And you get a nearly constant number of null responses. Again, you're expecting this because of the scale invariance of the image, of the images that you constructed. And let's now compare this to what we actually saw in natural scenes. That's not quite the same. For starters, this is the same body of scenes. This is the same, and these are the same filters. And while it's true that the power law correlation succeeded in maintaining the difference between the on and off. One thing it certainly did not reproduce is the number of null responses. There's something different about that. The number of null responses is here always larger than the number of positive and negative contrasts, and that's not the case here. And also the number of null responses drops here and doesn't do that there. So this is some kind of violation of scale invariance. And we also, of course, you know, all the papers that we see on scale invariance, they make beautiful and specific statements, right? What they do is they compute the two-point correlation function. And having computed the two-point correlation function, there's a particular range of frequencies people typically look at, and things are scale invariant in that range. And, you know, above the range, there may be finite size effects. Below the range, there may be sort of pixel effects and things like this. So all good. But but we all know that if you actually look at natural scenes, there's further stuff in it. For example, as various people pointed out, you know, there are bicycles lined up. You know, trees stand like this. The horizon is always like this, pretty much, with, you know, your head orientation being usually the way it is. So there's further structure in natural scenes.
When people show these natural scenes in talks, there's always an object in the scene of the order of the size of the picture, which is the most part of the picture. The fact that the null curve doesn't go to 1, doesn't it mean that you just have some object which is of the size of your picture always when you show the picture? You know, so you always have some contrast at the scale of the whole picture?
Well, I mean, not in all the images that we're looking at. I mean, there are pictures of, a cow that's yay big and a field that's yay big. You know, that's not an object that's the size of the screen. Besides, you know, if things were really, really scale invariant, then there may be objects at the size of the screen, but, you know, you focus in on the object, you should find other, quote, objects that, you know, scale down, right? There are fleas living on fleas, you know, that kind of thing. But that's not really the way the world works. And we're not here trying to cast doubt on the statements about scale invariance, but there's other interesting structure in natural scenes. For example, many people have been recently at least thinking about things like phase information. As I said, the power law arises after you average over phases in the Fourier domain. And that phase information is important. And for the particular data that we are studying, maybe that is essential. And let me point out that the way we did our artificial images is we used the averaged intensity distribution over many scenes, and similarly the power law over many scenes. If instead, but as I said, actual individual scenes don't necessarily have those properties, right? Individual scenes have very different intensity distributions. So maybe if there were a way of taking the intensity, well, we could take the intensity distributions of individual scenes, wipe out all the structure except the power law, do the analysis there, right? Since things are nonlinear, right? Do our analysis there, and then take the ensemble average. Maybe things would match up. So one point is that the phase information can be important. Another one is that, well, there are also higher order statistics. You know, there's a three-point function, there's a four-point function. Maybe those things have regularities. I don't know. That's an interesting thing to look into, and maybe that's important. along the same lines, there have been, in recent years, papers by people like De Bono and Viola and Portia and Simoncelli discussing texture synthesis models. As you said, you know, if you just use the power law and the natural intensity distribution, you get things that look like clouds. How do you get bark? How do you get sand? You know, the things that look like bark or sand. These people are trying to make some progress on these issues based on some old work by a guy named Jules or something. What they do, predictably, is they try to incorporate some aspects of higher order statistics into the texture synthesis. So we haven't yet looked into this, but it's interesting to ask. If you include just those elements of natural scenes that allow these people to produce textures, is that sufficient to reproduce our phenomenon? Right? We're trying to piece apart, again, what part of natural stimuli is relevant for the difference between on versus off processing or bright versus dark processing. Anyway, I already said this. We could have performed the contrast measurements on individual scenes, which have been remapped, to just keep the power law. And that's not what we did. OK. All right, so these are some thoughts about explaining what we just saw. However, I want to get back towards thinking about the retina. After all, the whole exercise started by trying to think about why are the retinal on versus off channels organized the way they are. So, and as I said, our basic hypothesis is that if you trade off somehow the amount of information you can extract versus the amount of resource you've got to commit, possibly you get some idea as to why off channels are smaller, overlap more, rectify more, etc. So to determine how much resource you should actually commit to bright versus dark processing, given the data that we have, what you really want to know is how useful is the information in bright versus dark patches. So for example, if you're a hawk, the kind of thing you're probably looking for is that, well, so if you're a rabbit, the kind of thing you're probably particularly interested in is that little dark patch which tells you that a hawk is coming down onto you, right? So that's a particularly important piece of information. Right? So you might wonder, so there are surely sort of behavioral issues like that that are presumably relevant. But unfortunately, as we all know, utility functions, behavior-driven utility functions of that kind, are extremely difficult to estimate. You know, how do you find out exactly how useful it is for you to find out that something is a little bright thing versus a dark thing? So, and particularly at the sort of elementary level of the retina, you may suppose, one thing that's certainly true is that the utility of information increases monotonically with the amount of information. You know, you give me 2 bits instead of one, I'm always free to throw away one. So any reasonable utility function is going to be monotonic in the amount of in the number of bits, straight bits that you get. So particularly at the elementary level of the retina, it's worthwhile for us as a first cut to simply explore how much information, in the sense of information theory, is there in the bright versus dark components of a natural scene. Okay, so that's what we're going to start doing now. We're going to study the information in these two components of the scene. And immediately, there's a problem. The problem is that the contrasts are a continuous variable. So how much entropy you assign, or how much information you assign to a contrast distribution, depends on what you believe are the minimum discriminable contrasts. Which is of course a little bit of a can of worms, because then you have to ask cell by cell, perhaps, you know, what are the individual thresholds for different organisms and different contrasts, etc. So since we are interested in characterizing natural scenes and perhaps the maximum amount of information that we can extract from a natural scene in the bright versus dark components, the way we do this is the following. So suppose you agree that you have 10 contrast levels that you're able to discriminate for whatever reason. If that's the case, given this particular distribution of contrasts, you can maximize your extraction of information by binning the contrast distribution in the following way. You chop up the distribution into bins such that each bin has an equal probability mass. This is histogram equalization. And and Laughlin, for example, in 1976, showed that fly LMC performs such a procedure. And of course, Bill is a famous exponent, and so is Pali, of this kind of optimization of information coming out of various kinds of distributions. I should say that if you actually believe that there was a constraint like energy efficiency or something like that in operation, and if you believe that, for example, going down this curve, you encode this with one spike, two spikes, three spikes, four spikes, then you actually shouldn't do histogram equalization. You should do something like histogram exponentialization. Namely, you should be exponentially less likely to use things down here. But I'm not going to do that. The reason I'm not going to do that is because I've not committed yet to what constraints are relevant to the retina. And I'm here more interested in characterizing the amount of information that's there in the bright versus dark channel, the maximum amount of information given n discrete contrast levels. Okay, so since our answer is going to depend on the number of discriminable levels in the system, of course, I'm not going to put too much weight on, and also on the way we've binned, I'm not going to put too much weight on the actual numbers we get. All I care about in this talk is how the information scales and changes as a function of the geometry of the contrast filter mosaic. We're, after all, interested ultimately in translating this information into something about how the mosaic of on and off cells should be organized and arranged in the retina. Just as an aside, I also want to mention that we could have used, instead of using this binning method, since clearly I'm sort of griping about the binning methods, there are binless methods of information estimation, which Tali, for example, has discussed. I also want to make, this is an aside, before I move on to actually doing these estimations. We might also ask whether this kind of idea of histogram equalization and sort of optimization of information transfer is directly relevant to one fact about the on versus off dichotomy that we mentioned earlier at the beginning of the talk. Recall that we said that on cells, off cells are more rectified than on cells. Namely, off cells only encode dark contrasts, whereas on cells encode both positive contrasts and a few negative contrasts. Well, so here is the contrast distribution. Recall that it's skew, with more probability mass on the left side for dark contrasts. So if you were supposed to, so suppose if it were the case, for example, that on and off channels could each encode 10 contrast levels, then the way you optimally transmit the information is you would chop off this distribution to two halves in an asymmetric way, and then encode these as 10 contrast levels and these as 10 contrast levels. So you would have an asymmetric threshold. So an optimal transfer of information from the contrast distribution would have an asymmetric threshold. And one would wonder whether this has something to do with the way the retina is organized. Basically, if there's an equal number of contrast levels efficiently encoded, off-channel should be more rectified. However, the reason why I'm not saying this is the explanation is there are many questions to be considered more carefully here. For example, are spatial contrasts encoded efficiently in the retina? How many levels of contrast can on and off cells distinguish? I actually don't know if there's an asymmetry between them. Right. Do you know, Dutch?
We think there's not.
We think there's not. Okay, fine. But I'm not totally sure. And there are effects of contrast adaptation. Also, detection of spatial contrast is intimately tied to eye movement in various ways. So there's a the argument requires a little bit more subtlety. But it's encouraging that it goes in the right direction. As you will see, repeatedly, the arguments always go in the right direction. So perhaps that's good circumstantial evidence that a theory of design can emerge for this particular aspect of retinal processing in this way. OK, so we need to compute information transmitted by contrast filter arrays. Now, in addition to the binning issue, there's another issue that the outputs of the various filters that you've built, the on and off cells, if you like, are not going to be statistically independent. We already showed that the natural scene had statistical dependencies, right? These power law correlations, etc. And while the contrast filters will, in fact, decorrelate the image somewhat, they're not going to decorrelate the image all the way. They just don't. And as a result, there's going to be statistical dependencies. So what you have to do, so because of that, you can't assume independence between different filters, estimate the information in a given filter, and then multiply by the number of filters. You have to construct arrays of filters and ask about the joint probability distribution of contrast encoded by a number of filters, and then compute the entropy of that distribution. That's all that's being written here. Also, what you're really interested in is the mutual information between the output of the on and off layer and the original stimulus. And that requires, of course, estimating the joint distribution of stimuli and the on-off filter output. However, in our case, we're working in a noiseless situation, right? The natural scene has no variation added onto it. And that's because there's no noise. The mutual information is simply the entropy of the output layer, so we can just compute that. I'll come back to the issue of noise later. It's a key issue that one should be thinking about. What's that?
Why do you say there's no noise?
Well, what we're doing is we've taken a particular scene, and we filter that and ask how much information there is about that scene, as is. Scene defined as the label of the image. But that's not noise. It's just stuff you throw away. So there's an information reduction, but it's not noise. What's really going on is there's some ideal scene of which you see a noisy incarnation. That's what's really going on. And we just simply have not built that into the analysis at all. And it's important, as I will mention later. Already, without doing that, we're going to get very nice results. But it would be very nice to do that too. And part of the issue is that the problem of estimating the entropy or the mutual information becomes extremely difficult. And this is where I hope to learn a little bit from you guys, because we would like a more efficient technique than what we've been using. We've been doing the dumb brute force thing of build up the joint probability distribution for as big an array for as you can get in data for, and memory for in your computer, and computed entropy. which is not necessarily the most efficient way of doing things, but that's what we did. Okay, so that's what I mentioned about the, there are serious data limitations, right? If you have 10 filters, each encoding 10 contrast levels, that's 10 to the 10 possible things that you would see. And of course, natural scenes explore a tiny fraction of the possibilities. But even algorithmically, writing something that could is able in principle to do 10 to the 10 possible variations, but only explores a small fraction of them, it's complicated. So we need more efficient techniques. Okay, so now we just computed the information in the contrast arrays in this way, and here's what we find. Well, first of all, before we do the contrast arrays, it's worth as a reality check to go to the actual scenes, the natural scenes, and just compute the information in a natural scene as a function of how many pixels you're talking about, right? You take 1 pixel by itself, 2 pixels, 3 pixels in an array, and you compute how much information they give you. And it's worth asking, just what's that? Just fun. It's interesting to look at. And here are a bunch of results. What I'm drawing here is, here's the entropy in an array of n pixels. So here there's 1 pixel, 2 pixels, 3 pixels, 4 pixels, etc. in the natural scene. So you basically build up the joint probability distribution of those pixels, discretized to 10 levels, and just ask, you know, how much entropy is there. And what you see is they all increase, as they would. But if you draw a picture of the entropy per pixel as a function of number of pixels, it decreases. And the reason for that is obvious. There's redundancy. Right? So what you're expecting is when you get to very large number of pixels, these curves will taper off and become flat, because after you have 10,000 pixels, the extra information from the 10,001st pixel is about the same as what you would get from the 10,002nd pixel, because you've got all the correlations built in into the analysis already. So this is, in some sense, a way of getting a handle on how many pixels do you need together before you have some sort of reasonable estimate that accounts for the redundancy. And as you can see, by the time you get to 6 pixels, things are kind of tapering off, which is sort of good news, because and we'll see that translates into useful facts about the contrast image too. So now there are 4 curves here. The first one, the black one, is Gaussian noise. And Gaussian noise is independent random pixels. That better darn well be a flat line if you do entropy per pixel. That's our reality check. Our code is working. And there you go. That's what you get. And you know, the 3.3 or whatever is log 10. That's the amount of information per pixel. Then the pink line is pink noise. So it has some correlations in it, some power law correlations. So you should find a little bit less information than you would in a Gaussian random noise. And indeed, you have less. And even the information per pixel sort of goes down, but starts to taper off and become a constant. That's good. And then an interesting thing we did was to, we split the images into rural versus urban. Roughly speaking, the division being, is there a cow or a bicycle, this being Holland. What do you know? There's a systematic and steady difference. And cities are more boring in the sense of amount of information in this sense. And that's not necessarily surprising. You know, a tangled bunch of moss, it clearly has more variability and whatnot than this nice flat tabletop. So something like that is going on. But it's worth keeping this in mind. Are there important environmental differences that are relevant for this analysis? At least now, yeah, of course. I don't know, because we didn't do that. I should do that. It will appear in the paper. But in any case, the fact that that thing is tapering off and becoming flat makes me feel very confidently that it's going to be bang on. You're right. Okay, we'll do the calculation. Easy enough to do so. So that should be. That's a very good reality check. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. Yeah, you might have, what you might actually be seeing is a very, very slow drop. That wouldn't change what we did, because we're only able to get up to 6 pixels anyway, but it would certainly inform our degree of belief in having captured the relevant correlations, and also how important it is for us to get a more sophisticated entropy estimation technique. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. All right. So now I'm going to draw. Now that was the intensity arrays. Now we're going to do the contrast arrays. So what do we see? So what's being done here is, so there are lots of variables, you know, right? When you get these contrast arrays, right? You have these cells. You have a mosaic of cells. There's the spacing between the cells. That's the array spacing. Array size. Then there's the size of the individual cells, so how big their centers are. Then then there's the number of cells, right? How many cells do you study at the same time? So and it's hard to vary all of these three things at the same time. It's certainly very hard to display them on the screen. So I'm going to do things by varying one thing at a time, and I'm telling you how things work out. So here what we're doing is that we have cells that are in a mosaic in which the center size is 5. And the array size is 5. So the excitatory centers are just touching, and you have this sort of even mosaic. And we have 6 of the cells. We have 1 through 6 of the cells. And the point of this picture is that you get more information in the negative contrast array than the positive contrast array at all scales. Now, by the negative and positive contrast arrays, what I mean is that you take the filter bank and the threshold, right? The positive contrast array is, it sends out a signal whenever there's a positive contrast and gives you zero otherwise. So that's what I mean by the positive and negative contrast array. Now, as a check of have we captured the redundancy, what you can do is you can sort of divide and find out the information per cell in the array as a function of the number of cells in the array. This looks like it's going down, so that, you know, there's more redundancy as you keep going bigger. But that's because I've actually blown up the scale to make it look like it's going down. I just want to see how much it's going down. If you look at this, you know, this declines from 2.1 to about 2. So it's a very, very slow decline. And if I pick the scale like this, you wouldn't even see it. This would be a completely flat line. So we believe that we have captured most of the redundancy, but Bill's caveat is an important one to keep in mind, and we will take that to heart before thinking about while thinking about this further. So another way of thinking about this is that there's less redundancy. If you remember the previous pictures, there's less redundancy in the contrast array than there was in the intensity array. In the intensity array, the fall off was much greater. And that's good, right? We're expecting the filter bank to decorrelate the stimulus to some degree. And so that's happened. And it's clear that it's happened, because the decline in information as you add more cells is less as you increase the size. It's also worth asking, what happens if you change the geometry of the mosaic? So what's being done here is the green line on the top is center size 5 and array size 10. So this means these are cells that have about yay big, but very far spaced apart. So they should be highly non-redundant. So you should find that basically as you increase the number of cells, the information you get just scales with the number of cells. And indeed, you find that the green line is dead straight and intersects 0 at the origin. I should have probably put 0 there too. But so that's a dead straight line. The filters don't overlap. They don't have any very much redundant information at all. Then the red line is center size 5, array size 5. That's the one I already had. And then the pink line is center size 5 and array size 1. So these are cells which overlap a lot. So you should expect that as you add more cells, initially you have a lot of redundancy. And it's only when you get many, many cells that the redundancy begins to taper off. And that's what you find. The pink line is not particularly straight, right? It's sort of tapering off in this way, because as you add more cells, the additional cells are giving you, you know, redundant information. They're not giving you as much information as the first cell gave you. OK, so that's a bunch of facts. Now, let me vary the other two axes. The other two axes were the size. So in the previous pictures, what I was doing was varying the number of cells that appeared in the array. And now we're going to work with arrays of 6 cells, because we agreed, at least at this moment, that 6 cells appears at this level to capture most of the redundancy And so we're going to stick with that for the moment. So given that, you can vary the center size, so you can make big, you can vary the scale of your mosaics. You can have a mosaic in which the cells get bigger and the mosaic gets bigger at the same time. So that here you have center size equals array size. So that's a mosaic that looks like this. Right? So that's a mosaic that looks like that. And then you can just simply change the scale of the mosaic, right? Increase the size of the mosaic from 1 pixel to 2 pixels to 5 pixels, 10, 15, 20, etc. And ask, how much information do you get in the bright versus dark component of the scene? And what you find is at all scales, there is more information in the dark component, namely the negative contrast component of the scene. Next, note it's not particularly scale invariant. But as you change the scale, something happens. It starts to get more scale invariant perhaps up there. But, well, I'm not sure. It's still going up. And we haven't yet fit a curve to this or anything to find out what the regularity is. This is still an ongoing work. Now, instead, here, let's look at a different thing. What we're doing here is we've got 6 filters with center size set to be 6 pixels or 5 pixels. And then we change how far their spacing is. So we start off with things that overlap a lot and then go to things that don't overlap very much. Right? Because that's also another thing, another axis along which the on-off cell mosaic varies. So again, so if you do that, you see as you increase the array spacing, you again see that at all scales, in that sense of scale, you get more information in the dark component, the negative contrast component of the scene. As I just said. So, and a sort of comment that's worth making here is that look at these pictures and then consider the fact that in an actual retina, the on cells are larger in scale than the off cells, right? If you take that for granted and plot the on and off here or here, you will find that the amount of information in the on channel is more equal to the amount of information in the off channel than you might have otherwise expected. If you had symmetric channels of the same of the symmetric mosaics of the on and off channels, the off mosaic would carry more information. But the way things have been organized, they're sort of more equal than you would have otherwise expected. Let me put it like that. Okay? And we will see in a moment that there could well be a reason for that. So, and you might wonder if there is here some sort of whatever the optimization principle, if any, that's there here, you might wonder if it pushes the system towards some kind of equalization of information between the different channels. And there's sort of anatomical evidence for this, which we were pleased to find from Harry Cao and Peter Sterling from some unpublished work that they have. So I think Peter talked about this briefly in his talk that he gave you a couple of weeks ago. But if you look at the dendritic arbors of on and off channels, the off channel has a much bigger dendritic arbor. However, the off channel dendritic arbor is much denser. And so the net number of synapses they make with bipolar cells is roughly the same. So as an order of magnitude, if you suppose that, you know, a synapse of the bipolar cell transmits so many bits per second or something, right? Just as an order of magnitude estimate, you might have estimated that despite the fact that you might have thought that the small off cells couldn't contact so many things coming in, that in fact they were gathering as much input information as the larger on cells. You might have thought that. Namely, you might have thought, what's being proposed here is an anatomical correlate of information transfer, right? A cell processes more information, it makes more synapses, period. Right? It gathers more, it sends out more. So it's something like that that's being proposed. And it's interesting, so we're not going to claim that as a result, but it's interesting that, again, things point in the same direction. And you might ask if, in general, can we, having done all these analyses, these experimental analyses, basically, of natural scenes, can we formulate a trade-off between the asymmetric information that we see in the bright and dark channels and resource consumption, space, energy, etc., that leads either to this information equalization or some other design principle that could perhaps explain the detailed structure and function, like size, overlap, and rectification, of on versus off channels. So let's take a first stab. Right? So this is something we're actively working on, and we're not really ready to report our detailed results. Well, we're far from having detailed results. But there's a first stab that immediately gives a very nice result, so I couldn't resist sort of putting it up in front of you. So let's suppose that for some reason, some kind of resource constraint, there's a limit to the number of cells we can devote to the number of beta cells we can build in CAT. Right? I'm not quite sure what this constraint, where this would come from, but you might imagine that given all the other things that your eye has to do, your eye can spend so much money on building beta cells. And let's also assume, for purpose of argument for the moment, that the on and off cells cost an equal amount. Far from clear that that's true, but anyway, let's just take it for the moment. If that's the case, then the relevant constraint for our problem of how you should organize the on and off channel is that there are n cells. And you can convert this, if you don't like, n cells into cell density of n, you know, cells per unit area. It doesn't matter. The analysis will work in the same way. So then let n on be the number of on cells, so that the number of off cells is n minus n on, of course. And let me assume, to reduce the number of variables that I've got to present on the screen right now, that both on and off cell mosaics tile the retina with the center size equal array size spacing. Okay, so it's this kind of a mosaic. So the centers just touch, so the surrounds overlap, right? So it's a minimal overlap. And of course, we could redo this analysis allowing the variable of what the array spacing is and what the center size is, etc. But I'm not going to do that at the present time. We're still doing that. So we have only one variable in town, the number of on cells. Everything else is determined in terms of that, because the number of off cells is the difference, n minus n on. And the geometry is fixed. You tile with minimal overlap. Again, this is the absolute simplest model you would always make of the retinal mosaic. Right? This is what people do. At first cut, things tile, and they just touch. At first cut. And then the rest is details. OK, so then let little I on be the amount of information per cell in the on array as a function of the on cells. Now, the reason why of the number of on cells. The reason why I on will be a function of the number of on cells is because, of course, as you change the number of on cells, as I've said, the geometry of the array, of the on array, is changing. So if it changes, as we've already seen, as you change the structure of the on array, the amount of information per cell changes. So, okay. And then the total information you transmit is going to be, of course, the number of on cells times the information per on cell times the number of off cells times the information per off cell. So now what we want to do is maximize the total information as a function of n on. So we need to vary the information with respect to n on. And this thing here is the result that you get. You get the difference between the number of on, between the amount of on information and off information per cell is given by the number of on and off cells multiplying this variation of the amount of information you get as a function of the number of cells you have. What's that?
This assumption that the information is simply additive
is not at all clear. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's sort of true. You know, there's the bright component, there's the dark component. And that's indeed the case. But there could be interactions between the on and the off.
Additive in the on, and each of the cells, it's not really.
Well, no, but it is by definition, you see. So the n on, I on is by definition. Remember the way we defined information
on,
per cell.
Total information
divided. Exactly. So I've just written it in that manner. I could, because of the way we did our analysis, right? What we do is we always take these large mosaics, compute the information in the mosaic, and then divide by the number of cells. I didn't claim it was. I on is a function of n on. That's not extensive, right? Clearly, otherwise the derivative, you know. So this is the first thing there is definitional. N on, I on is definitional. Now there's an additional question of whether you can simply add the information in the on and off channel. I'm just assuming that for the moment. That's the sort of first order true because, you know, bright and dark are different things, and well, there you go. But that's a question that's worth analyzing too. And in my list of things to do in the next transparency, you will find that that is one of the things that appears. Okay. So the next comment is that when the number of cells is very large, as in the retina, the information per cell, in this sense, will be nearly independent of the number of cells, since increasing the number of cells by one doesn't change the geometry very much. Another way of saying this is that it's the pictures I was trying to show earlier that as you get more and more cells in your array and you make the bigger and bigger array, basically the redundancy is plateauing off. This brings us, however, to the important question that Bill raised. It's really...
Actually, you get there a little faster. Remember that what you actually get there is a logarithmic derivative, right? So the statement that the I off, N off, is a small number is
yeah.
not quite enough to do what you need because it ends up getting multiplied by N off.
Yeah.
So it could that product could remain order one.
No. Because the di off n off, as in the pictures that I was showing, it's not scaling. It's not going to scale you're saying that if it turns out to be something of order 1 over n, right? Is that what you're going after? Okay, good. That's
like if you actually need the logarithmic derivative to be going to 0. Right?
I need di dn to be going to 0.
Well, since it ends up being multiplied by n, you need di
log. Okay. So Bill is raising the point that because of the power law correlations, his bet is that when things are done, or maybe he's raising the possibility that rather than approaching constant, what's going to happen is that the information per cell is going to scale logarithmically.
I guess I'm making a much simpler problem, which is that you said since the I off the n seems to be going to 0, the right-hand side goes to 0.
And it depends on the rate.
And it actually depends on the rate.
Yeah.
It would be hard to exclude from anything that you've done that the right hand side actually becomes order one.
Yeah, but however, if what you say is correct, that it's going, let's say that di dn goes as 1 over n. That means I goes as log n, correct? Okay. So if di dn is like 1 over n, then I goes as log n. If that's the case, the left-hand side is going to be proportional to log n, whereas the right-hand side is going to be order 1, right? So the only way you're going to satisfy log n is equal to order 1 is if the thing that's appearing multiplying the log n, the numbers there are going to get very small. So there's something here that's going to be almost equalized. There's a difference in orders between the left and right sides. But as far as the argument that this is not settled, it's not settled. I'm just presenting a seat of the pants argument with assumptions all over the place that show you that if you do the basic obvious thing, it's always encouraging if the basic obvious thing gives the right answer. And then you have to work the details to get the correct answer. I mean, we don't actually know. So the result of this, of course, if the right-hand side is going to 0, then you get this information equalization. We don't actually know that the on and off channels had equal information. You know, I'll bet money that it's not exactly equal. It is whatever it is, and maybe different between cells. We don't want an excessive prediction here either, right? So all I'm saying, but the anatomical evidence suggests that it'll be close. And all I'm saying is that the structure of that equation already, with these minimal assumptions, suggests that it's going to be close. And now we would like to improve our analysis to try to put in more of the features of the actual behavior of the actual structure of the retina and also further analysis of these natural scenes. Namely, does this thing scale as log n, or does it actually or is it a constant? Right? I mean, one thing we could do is, for example, just fit curves. And see, is it scaling as log n, right? Where we can get a few more data points and fit it and compare for the tail. Does log fit better than a constant? I mean, there are ways of at least trying to get some grips on that. So we will, and that's a good point. Anyway, in any case, under this set of assumptions, which are, as I said, the basic minimal thing you would start with if you're going to do a blackboard calculation, what you find is that the information is equalized. And if that's the case, you need to make larger on cells than off cells, because otherwise the information per cell won't be equalized. And that fits with what we've been saying. So again, as I said, because we don't have a complete analysis yet, we're not willing to claim a result. However, everything we do points in the same direction, that these structural asymmetries between bright and dark components and natural scenes is directly relevant for the structure of the retina. And I actually I'd be willing to put some money down saying that there is something driving the on and off channels towards equalizing the amount of information. Not exactly equal. I mean, that's sort of always a ridiculous statement to make. But there's something making them more similar to each other, because this is the kind of thing one often sees when a system optimizes the information transfer through multiple channels. You often see things like there's a relation between how much information goes here versus here, given other parameters. So I actually think that, and what's beautiful is that if there's an anatomical correlate of that, right? Anatomy is a complicated thing. It would be lovely if there were some way to say things about how anatomy should be given some sort of abstract design principle. I mean, others here have been thinking about that kind of thing too, of course. So let me just mention a few things on our to-do list. So one thing we would like to do is to identify which properties of natural scenes fully account for the bright versus dark asymmetries. For example, considering texture models, there's the issue of environmental dependence. One issue that I have not put up here, but which Bill raised, is this issue of, is it scaling or is it going to a constant? Is it scaling as log n? That's something that we will be looking into. Other kinds of contrast models, right? We used, that was another issue that Bill raised, which is, we used a particular contrast model. And of course, our results are correct with our contrast model. But it's interesting to ask, you know, how do things change? I mean, the invariant thing will be the differences between the different pictures. But then it's also interesting to ask which contrast model is relevant to retina. So then there's trade-offs between space usage, energy usage, and information transmission in on and off channels. That's part of what we've started to discuss here. You know, what are the various trade-offs you should build in? Then the effects of noise. So, so the information content of filters which have which are very small is going to get reduced if you understand the picture that you're seeing as a noisy version of the, you know, Platonic ideal image that you really wanted to see. And this kind of inclusion of noise, I believe, is absolutely essential for any comparison with data. So actually, Gonzalo, before I started this talk, suggested that it would be a good idea to sort of emphasize this point. So I'm actually going to deviate a little bit and just put up a couple of figures to explain why noise is so important, and then we'll go back and just basically finish the talk. So both Simon Laughlin and Chip Levy, so one of the things we're interested in is, you know, what are the constraints that are important? And one of the constraints that could be important is energy. But the comments I'm making will apply to sort of any kind of optimization you want to do. And both Chip Levy and Simon Laughlin, for example, talked about energy efficiency in previous talks. Now, in all of these optimization problems, the kind of thing we have in mind is that there's some sensors, they collect some data S, they transcribe it as some data X, that goes into an encoder, the encoder encodes it as a data Y, it comes out through a channel which adds noise, and comes out as some signal Z that goes to the brain. You know, classic, you know, you could have taken this kind of picture from Shannon's papers, right? But that's sort of in the back of our mind, the way we think. Now, I have not organized the slide very carefully, but let me just, I just want to talk about what noise would mean. Now, let's suppose that you have an alphabet that you're going to use to send information, which consists of the letters 1 through 6 for fun, right? Okay. And now let's suppose that in passing through this channel, there's noise added so that with a probability 2p, the symbol 1 becomes symbol 2, and with probability 1 minus 2p, it stays itself. The symbol 2 becomes symbol 3 with probability p, or symbol 1 with probability p, probability 1 minus 2p, it stays itself. In other words, you know, the classic sort of classic symmetric noise channel that one would talk about. So what you could try to do is you could try to design a code that optimizes the information transfer through the channel. And I'm not going to discuss how such a code is constructed. But what I'm drawing here, and what this is actually a picture taken from a situation where there's also an energy constraint. You can't, there's a constraint on how much energy you have in your transmission, and the various symbols have an energy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. So in the absence of noise, it turns out that when you do the optimizations, which I'm not going to discuss, you wind up with an exponential distribution of symbol usage for the optimal code. But once you add noise, and as you crank up the noise, here there's noise, the amount of noise is 0.1, 0.2, 0.25, the curves get all jiggly and wiggly, right? It matters, actually, you can even show in the language of physics that as a function of the noise, there are phase transitions in the structure of the optimal curve. What happens is that the curve looks reasonably smooth until some critical value of this noise parameter P, and you go just over it, and it goes click. And then the thing looks different qualitatively. And the reason this is so important is in biology, if you have noise, well, you know, which side, if this kind of optimization principle involves phase transitions, it matters which side you live on for the qualitative structure of your predictions. So as an example of why this is so important, I'm going to describe, I'm just going to put up a couple of pieces of data from some work by Michael Berry and myself and Don Kimber, and show you that the noise is essential. Gonzalo has a very nice paper doing similar things with cortical neurons. What I'm drawing here is some data from salamander retina. What you can do is you can measure the burst size distributions in salamander retina. The way salamander responds to stimuli is it goes bam, 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 makes bursts of spikes. So in each burst of spikes, you can count up how many spikes they are, and histogram, how often you use bursts of size 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. And from different cells in different salamanders, here are some curves. Notice there's this characteristic fall off always at large things, which is sort of exponential. And for some of them, there's this dip. So what I'm going to say is that suppose you try to model, you might try to explain why you don't use large bursts very often by some kind of resource constraint. Why should you send 6 spikes when you can send 5, when 6 spikes are much more expensive energetically, as Simon would say, as Simon Laughlin would say. But you can't explain these dips in that way, right? 1 spike is much less expensive than 5 spikes. So there's something qualitatively wrong with saying that these pictures might be explained by an optimization principle of, you know, optimize information transfer with subject to some resource constraint. Okay, so let's see how you would get around that. So what you can do is in these cells, you can measure the noise. You can measure noise in the following sense, present the same stimulus, do 50 trials, and let's say you find that here's a particular stimulus event, which on average produces 3 spikes. And you can ask, you know, sometimes it produces 4, sometimes it produces 2, etc. And that's the noise. It's how often a symbol, which is K spikes, becomes something else. It's the jitter in the spike count. And this is a picture in a matrix form of the jitter in the spike count, reproduced horribly. It's all black. This is supposed to be grayscale. Anyway, this is supposed to be dark along the diagonal and sort of dying out like that. Anyway, okay, so that's, you can measure the noise. And then you can sort of fold it into your optimization analysis. And here's what you find. For this analysis, you also need the energy costs of the different burst sizes. And you can just assume, you can show from a compartmental model that the energy cost of spikes of a burst is linear in the number of spikes. So anyway, that's folded in two. So here's what you get. So the theory of optimal coding with energy constraints with the noise folded in produces these dark curves. The light curves above and below are the 1 sigma deviations from these things, or 2 sigma deviations from these, 1 sigma deviations from these things. And the actual dots with the error bars are the data for the actual distributions of burst size usage in salamander. The fits are beautiful. And across all cells we looked at, you know, the order 1 chi-squared was order 1 and stuff like that. The point I'm trying to emphasize here is that there is no way in hell you'd match this if you didn't include the noise. The qualitative effect of the reduction of usage of 1 and 2 spike bursts is explained theoretically by the fact that noisy symbols shouldn't be used quite so often, at least within this paradigm of thinking. And if you didn't include the noise, you wouldn't get a fit. And so for many of these energy efficiency discussions and for any of these constraint optimization discussions, I think this is a key point that must be kept in mind. One more thing. So Gonzalo has a nice paper showing this for cortical neurons also. Yeah. So Susanna?
The noise is really a channel.
No, that's yeah, that's. I'm not sure it should be thought directly off of as channel noise in that sense. I mean, that's just a way of thinking, as far as I'm concerned, right? I mean, the noise could have come in all the way from the input, starting with photon noise, or it may not even be noise in the sense that what you might be seeing is correlated.
If the noise is an input, then you want to eliminate it. Actually, you have some control over it.
Okay, okay.
You have channel.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So I'm talking about the empirically measured variation from trial to trial. The origin of that empirically measured variation from trial to trial is not really known, right? Various people have discussed that kind of thing in this during this period. It's also not even known if it's noise. What I mean by that is that there could be correlated variations between, you know, multiple cells. And maybe it isn't really noise. But even so, even if there are correlated variations between multiple cells, then the optimal code, including the multiple cells, will have this kind of effect for the single cell distribution. So I completely agree with you. But it's an empirical fact that there is trial-to-trial variation in single cell recordings. And it's an empirical fact that if you fold that in into sort of a resource-constrained optimization, you get beautiful fits with exact, well, with fits of order chi-squared 1, but, you know, that's a misleading statistic because that chi-squared depends on the error bars, right? You know, it's nice to say chi-squared of order 1, but anyway, okay, fine. But the important point, as far as I'm concerned, is the qualitative feature of the suppression of noisy symbols is reproduced. And so I believe that including that kind of analysis of variation in your optimizations is very important, as it will be, I think, for us. I think we need to fold that in into our thinking. Susanna had a question.
I just wanted to know what the difference
was in 4 different retinas. Oh, this is just 4 different cells. This is an average of a retina. This is a cell by cell.
But your lines of prediction.
Yeah, so for so in the theoretical prediction, what's the variable? The variable in each one is the energy cost of a spike relative to the cost of silence, which surely varies from cell to cell. Even in a compartmental model, you can simply integrate up the cost of opening and closing ion channels. And they just, you know, make a cell this big versus this big, there's a difference. And the dendritic arbor matters and all these kinds of things. So since we don't know for the particular cells in question, I mean, that's an interesting experimental challenge that I would pose. Can one, during an experiment, measure the energy usage of a cell? Even estimate it in some way. So we're trying with Peter to come up with ways of measuring energy consumption in cells, but that's at a preliminary stage. So for us, it's a one parameter. So it's a one parameter fit. Notice that these things are, you know, 6 and 5 data points, so it isn't an overfit. There's only one parameter in town. Okay. Okay, so this was a detour inspired by Gonzalo's haranguing me earlier that noise is important. So yes, noise is important. And here's evidence for that. But now I wish to go back and finish the talk. Whoops. Right, so the final point I want to raise here is how do statistics of eye movements affect the story? Because you really only see spatial contrast via the eye movements. If you fixate it somewhere, you'd eventually everything would sort of gray out. So I think that's relevant. Dutch doesn't think so. He's wrinkling his brow and looking disgusted. Right. So, and finally, you know, we're basically doing a complete dump of the information from the retina into bright versus dark, whereas actually individual cells have different functions, this, that, and the other. And there's a question of how we would build that in. So I'd like to finish by retreating from the details of what we just said to a little bit concerning the broader picture of what we have in mind as what we'd like to think about. So as I said before, the brain is an immensely heterogeneous and very, very diverse design. And the retina alone, as we said at the very beginning, expresses huge numbers of cells wired in, however, in sort of stereotyped ways. And you might ask, why should there be this kind of design? Why are there so many types of cells? Why are they wired the way they are? Because, well, you could have thought that you could have built an arbitrary computer using NAND gates. And again, our purpose is to go after the hypothesis that this sort of very heterogeneous design exists to efficiently extract and process information, or useful information anyway, in the presence of various kinds of constraints. It's not obvious that this is, you know, going to give, can or should give any kind of complete theory of design, but the question is if there's some part of a theory of design that is related to this. Certainly, for example, Mitya will give a talk later, I think, in this week, in which he will discuss how minimizing wire length, you know, efficiency in spatial organization, that goes a great deal of the way for predicting the organization of connection connectivity in C. elegans, right? In C. elegans. Well, that's interesting. So it's worth keeping these things in mind, particularly when design principles are so few. We should try for anything we have, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and then we move along. So, as I said, you know, this hypothesis you could imagine it instead functioning as a sort of organizational principle, right? We write down biology and neuroscience has been for a while in a descriptive stage, where we describe the different structures and patterns and things that happen. It would be nice to have organizational principles so that you can have a chapter heading for the details underneath. Okay, and so we intend this particular work and what we're going to continue to do basically is a foothold. We're taking a very simple thing, a very simple aspect of the design, which is the segregation of bright and dark processing, and we wish to see how far we can go to explaining the aspects of this, the actual aspects of this, in terms of the principles described above. I'm done, thank you. Sam.
Since this asymmetry might be different in different species, so for instance, moles would probably spend a lot more time in the dark.
Yeah.
Have you thought about looking for differences in the on-off ratio, size ratio, or number ratio in moles and so on?
Yeah, we've certainly considered that. What we'd like to, I think that would be sort of very interesting to do, I think, is to, first of all, accumulate in detail the data for different kinds of organisms and different kinds of environments, and then try to see if we could get, you know, a collection of 100 snapshots from what the mole sees. That's not as easy as it sounds, because the mole lives underground.
I wouldn't do that first. I would get a mole first and look at the retina and then see if it's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Look at the retina and see whether it was worth going anywhere.
Yeah. I think there are some variations. But Dutch, do you know?
I don't know anything about moles. Do they have homes?
I think so. I think are there mammals that don't have homes?
Well, I mean, let's just take goldfish versus monkey. Goldfish. Attic and redlick had a famous paper, as you know, trying to explain variations in center. Yeah. Hey, that's fair enough. Of course.
Dwelling primates.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Amsterdam-dwelling primates, if you extract the retina, there's likely to be some trouble from various authorities. That's a pity, perhaps. But anyway, then we do guinea pig as the experimental animal in Peter's lab, for example. That's of course, well, someone may say that evolved in the highlands of Peru, but actually it's a lab animal. Right. So what it sees is whitewashed walls. I don't know. So it's a good question. We haven't done that. It would be interesting to do. If you have any suggestions, we'd love some. Do you have any data?
Well, the lab thing doesn't matter. Yeah. Shorter than the time scale.
Understood.
Likely would be cut shorter than the time scale evolution.
I'm being facetious. But if you have any suggestions, we'd appreciate it. That's a good suggestion. Bill?
In trying to think about one of the problems in this style is that you're connecting the properties of natural images to those response characteristics of neurons. But of course, you're talking about static images, you're talking about ensembles in some way, and we know the code's adaptive. So we know that you can shift your zero point.
Yeah.
Right? That's light dark adaptation. We know that you can shift your gain and your dynamic range.
Yeah.
That's adaptation to the variance. We heard from Marcus that you could reshape the receptive field in space.
Yeah.
It's been known for a long time you can reshape it in time.
Yeah.
I guess what you can't do is turn an on cell into an off cell.
That would be a good hypothesis.
So there's no, you can't adapt and actually flip the sign of the response.
We believe that's the case.
But I guess what worries me is that you might think that since you can do things like adapt your dynamic range and your zero point, that if you're leaning too heavily on the
The argument is essentially you're looking at you're encoding scalar, but you got by filtering the image. Modified linear filtering, but still by filtering. You're encoding a scalar, and it's something about the asymmetries and the shapes of the distribution.
And the correlations.
And, right. But if I can sort of adjust my gain, that's kind of equivalent to reshaping the...
So the gain...
So there's something about where zero is.
So our thing does not care about the zero, because of course the mean luminance of any kind will be wiped out.
Yeah. But in order to define on and off, where zero is matters. I mean, I'm not saying
that's
where zero is
the
original image.
Right, but
you have to agree on where zero is.
Right.
For example,
there's sort of a natural place where you might have thought of putting zero, at least with this kind of measure of contrast, which is some kind of center minus surround, scaled in whichever way you want. Okay, that's because if you look at that distribution of center minus surround, scaled in whichever way you want, it's very kurtotic and it does this. There's an important feature down here. So that's a natural place where things want to divide. As it turns out, things don't actually divide there. As I mentioned, there's an asymmetric division, right? The off cells sort of take a little bit to the left of that, and on cells go a little bit to the right of that. And that's one of the features you'd like to understand. And as I mentioned, at a very naive level, if you were optimizing information transfer in the two channels, you would make an asymmetric threshold. So we're certainly thinking about that. Right?
I guess what I'm wondering about is whether in practice, in retina, the definition of the zero point by averaging over time isn't more important than the definition by averaging over time.
This is an important question.
Not a question. In some sense, it's not a question of principle about the approach. It's a question of whether we should start thinking about: are we going to understand the retina in terms of static images? Or do you really have to...
I couldn't agree more. So our results about natural scenes, as a fact about natural scenes, static images, stands.
Yeah.
However, to connect to the retina, it's important that we move our eyes. And it's important that the retina adapts. As I said, you know, if you just stared at a scene and your eyes didn't saccade or anything, the image would blur out. So all of this, it's hard to believe that all of these things do not play some kind of role. So what we presented is lots and lots of circumstantial evidence pointing in exactly the same direction, to the extent that, you know, in this space of time, maybe you didn't have time to sink in. But once you've done, you know, 15 checks, and they all come out in the same direction, at least the person doing the checks begins to feel perhaps a misplaced sense of confidence that this is going to go in the correct direction. But we certainly feel that including the temporal aspects of the processing, the spatiotemporal filter, may be important. How the eye moves may be important, and including contrast adaptation may be important. I mean, there's both short and long scale, and long time scale contrast adaptations. I'm not personally that familiar at this point yet with the literature on how those have been modeled, what exactly is known about them. We're talking to Michael Berry about trying to include, about thinking about how adaptation affects this analysis. So we'll have, I hope, in the next iteration of this work, we'll have more to say about that. But it's an excellent point. I mean, we don't look at static images. Even if you present us with a static image, the brain doesn't get a static picture because the eye moves all the time, and that's somehow a key fact concerning the, you know, change of orientation of this, of the spatial filters and things like that Marcus was talking about. That could well happen here too, of course. Because, as I said, we're doing a basically total dump of the information in the bright versus dark channels using these sort of very symmetric receptive fields. Whereas actual cells, well, you know, they have different functions, they do different things, etc. So segregating that information further into different kinds of functions and is necessary to get a more detailed theory. Basically, I think what one has to do is look carefully at the actual system you're studying and build in the details one by one. So we felt that the first thing to understand was the structure of the natural scene. And we feel we've gone some distance of the way to that. And all our preliminary indications indicate that if you just put in your facts about what the retina is trying to do, you will go in the right direction. So we'll continue. Any more questions? All right, I'm done.